This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The only information that we got this morning is that the Prime Minister's guards, when they arrived this morning, they were told that he left the night guards to South Africa.
Let's go to Deputy Commissioner of Police Paseka Moketi on the Prime Minister's disappearance on the day he was scheduled to be in court to be charged with murdering his first wife. Details coming up also. South Sudan's politicians will form a unity government tomorrow for almost 7 years of brutal civil war that has killed up to 400,000 people. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, police in Lesotho have threatened to charge Prime Minister Thomas Tambane's lawyer with defeating the hands of justice if it is found that he intentionally misled them when he said Tabani would appear in court today. Tabani had been scheduled to be formally charged with the murder of his first wife. Instead, he left early morning, reportedly to seek medical treatment in South Africa. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Deputy Commissioner of Police Paseka Mokete, who is the lead investigator in the murder case, told the media there was no arrangement or communication that Tabane would skip the court appearance.
The only information that we got this morning is that the Prime Minister's guards, when they arrived this morning, they were told that he left the night guards to South Africa. So at that time we thought that, well, he had attended medical checkups and hoping to be back by at least by now. So we're not sure as to whether he would come back.
Mokete said the police would, for now, give Tabane time to return and face the charges before deciding whether to issue a warrant of arrest against him. Tabane's current wife, Maesaya, has already been charged with ordering the murder of Tabane's first wife, Lipole Tabane. Maesaya, who is free on bail, briefly fled to South Africa before returning to Lesotho, where she was formally charged. Dipolelo was shot dead near her home in Maseru on June 14, 2017. At the time, she and her husband were going through a bitter divorce. Dipolelo's friend, Tato Sibola, who was wounded during the shooting, has fled to South Africa, saying she feared for her life. The shooting happened 2 days before Tabane was sworn in as a prime minister. Tabane has announced that he intends to step down in July, if not earlier, following pressure from his ruling All Basotho Convention Party. Tabane's son, Potlako, has been quoted by media as saying his father has not run away from justice, but was in South Africa for medical attention. Thabo Takale Koyala, a secretary in Tabane's office, has also been quoted in the media saying the Prime Minister is expected back in the country this weekend. Police have insisted they have a strong case against Tabane, including telephone records showing that a cellular phone from the murder scene was in contact with another cellular phone at Tabane State residence. The South African authorities have yet to confirm if indeed Tabane is in that country, and if so, whether he intends to go back and face justice. However, yesterday Tabane was in South Africa to inform President Cyril Ramaphosa about his intention to resign. Ramaphosa was appointed by the Southern African Development Community to facilitate peace in Lesotho following an attempted coup by the army. Lesotho is a landlocked country completely surrounded by South Africa. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And as VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg, Tabane's decision to step down could resolve Lesotho's long-running political crisis.
Tiny Lesotho's political problems are again threatening to overflow into South Africa, with Prime Minister Tom Tabane crossing the border instead of appearing in a Maseru court to face charges. His current wife, Maisia, is already charged with the murder and is out on bail despite the fact that she previously fled to South Africa to avoid prosecution. She was arrested shortly upon her return to Lesotho. The couple have denied any involvement in the shooting death of Dipolelo Tabane, just days before the prime minister was elected to his second term. Tom Tabane previously served as prime minister from 2012 to 2014, but fled the country, claiming that the military was trying to overthrow and kill him. Fako Moshweshwe, chairman of the parliamentary caucus for the ruling All Basotho Convention, told VOA's Peter Claudie that Tabane's party is expediting plans to come up with a replacement.
Now they have to call the caucus as soon as possible, as soon as Monday, so that we can sit down and come up with one name, definitely. Then the National Executive of ABC will have to respond immediately on those issues and come to the caucus and just let us know who they think will be the right prime minister, will be the right person to become a prime minister. Then we'll take it from there.
Moshweshwe declined to say who might be Tabane's successor. Tabane's tenure has been marred with drama, including a number of killings of high-ranking officials in recent years. Critics say this is an inevitable consequence of Tabane's failure to keep the nation's security forces out of politics. For now, the tiny mountain kingdom, which is led by a constitutional monarch, appears calm. Economist Emmanuel Letete says the political drama has taken its toll.
It has created some bit of uncertainty to the investors that they are no longer sure what is going to happen to the government or not. You see, they hear news about the prime minister, about the prime minister retiring, about the prime minister involved, probably or suspected to have been involved in the murder of his wife. But then all this creates a very dark cloud on the economy in terms of foreign investors, because they cannot make their own decisions whether to come or not.
Moshweshwe appealed to leaders in the enclave nation, which is surrounded on all sides by South Africa, to keep calm and carry on.
He appealed to each and everyone in our country, not especially political leaders, to make sure that they see that the peace and prosperity of the country as well, for the sake of the country.
Maisia Tabane's murder trial is set to begin March 17th. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
After a last-minute decision by South Sudan's President Salva Kiir to agree to a key demand by SPLOIO rebel leader Riek Machar on the number of states in the war-torn country, South Sudan's politicians will form a unity government tomorrow after almost 7 years of brutal civil war that has killed up to 400,000 people. But the new united government will still face major challenges, including security arrangements for the capital, Juba, continued fighting in the country's southern Equatoria region, and a devastating humanitarian situation. For more, Miklos Gostonia, a conflict analyst with the Norwegian Refugee Council, spoke with VOA's Jason Patinkin about the significance of South Sudan's new government.
It truly is an important moment. For 15 months since the peace agreement was signed, the South Sudanese population has been waiting for its leaders to come together and form the transition. There are a number of concerns, of course, that come attached with this, not least the fact that security arrangements are being rushed in order to meet that deadline. It remains to be seen what exactly will happen next week in terms of Machar's protection. And, of course, the idea of having IO come back to Juba raises serious concerns, given the history of how events unfolded in December 2013 and July 2016.
And so the IO being the rebels in 2013, before the rebellion began, Machar and Kiir, of course, were together in government, and that fell apart in July 2016 after a previous unity government between the two men was made and the rebel IO force came back to Juba. Soon after, there was lots of fighting, many people died, and things collapsed. So there's a fear that this could essentially happen for a third time, now that these two men will be back together in government for a third time.
Exactly. Historical precedent in this case is worrisome because the reality of what has been depicted as the civil war in South Sudan, really the two triggers were fighting within the presidential guard, the elements supporting Riek Machar, the SPLM-IO, and the President Kiir's own presidential guard. So those were the triggers of the war. The war started in Juba. So the idea of bringing back Ayo to Juba to give a protection to Machar, given historical precedent, is worrisome.
One of the major effects of this latest war and of previous wars has been on the humanitarian situation of the ordinary civilians of South Sudan. There's around 2 million refugees who have fled South Sudan during the last 7 years of war. There have been another 2 million displaced within South Sudan. There's been a famine. There have been outbreaks of cholera, a devastating humanitarian situation for millions of South Sudanese. Are we going to see an improvement on that situation now that there looks to be some kind of unity government coming in place?
Of course, we hope that's going to happen. However, the indicators do not show that optimism in the sense that the humanitarian situation in South Sudan, at least in terms of food security, has actually deteriorated over the past few months and will likely deteriorate further over the next few months. There's a fundamental factor here at play, which is the major flooding that happened in South Sudan last year. If we look at the numbers, we see that even before the flooding happened, the humanitarian situation in South Sudan or food security situation in South Sudan did not improve in spite of the peace agreement. And the reason is relatively simple. The level of food insecurity in South Sudan is not the result of the latest war. It is a result of generations and generations in which fighting took the form of the forced displacement of civilians and the destruction of their livelihoods. It's a problem that is deeply ingrained and that will unfortunately not be solved in anytime soon following the formation of the government. Now, the formation of the government can allow for certain things. It can allow for better humanitarian access so that humanitarians can deliver aid more easily and also without bureaucratic impediments. Hopefully, as part of the process, peace process that's happening in Rome, Thomas Cirillo and Paul Malong will be brought to join the government, and the situation in the Equatorias will hopefully improve. And the Equatorias are central to any future of a South Sudan that's more food secure, because the Equatorias constitute the breadbasket of the country. That's where most South Sudanese farmers live. It's the lands that produce the better crops. It's the land that can feed the country if the conflict ends. So it is central from a food security point of view that the war in the Equatorias stop, that offenses in the Equatorias stop, and that farmers in particular, who for the most have fled to Uganda, can return to their land, crop, and harvest. Now, it's clear is that for farmers to feel comfortable to go back to South Sudan to take care of their land and to harvest is that they need more than a fragile peace agreement. They need more than a fragile ceasefire. They need to feel confident to stay in their land for one or two seasons until the land can start producing food again.
That was Miklos Gostonia, a conflict analyst with the Norwegian Refugee Council, speaking with my colleague Jason Patinkin. You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. 18 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Police in Lesotho have threatened to charge Prime Minister Thomas Tambene's lawyer for misleading the country's court. And South Sudan's politicians will form a unity government tomorrow after almost 7 years of brutal civil war that has killed up to 400,000 people. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Like other African countries, Kenya's government has ruled out evacuating its citizens from Wuhan, China, the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak that has killed more than 2,000 people. The government says instead it will provide financial support to those stranded and psychosocial support for their families. Rael Ambor reports.
Kenya's government said that its citizens stuck in Wuhan City, the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak, are safer staying where they are. The announcement came amid demands for evacuation by the families of about 100 Kenyans stuck in the city, a majority of them students on Chinese scholarships. Speaking Thursday, Government spokesperson Cyrus Oguna said none of the students had contracted the disease, but if they flew back home, they could put others at risk.
They're a very wise government that looked at things in broad totality, not based on what others are doing, but based on what we think is the right for our children. These Kenyans are coming from different, you know, locations of Wuhan, and they'll be assembled in one central location. Through that movement, the potential of any of them getting infected cannot be ruled out. Now, if one of them gets infected, the possibility that the other 100 or so will get infected again cannot be ruled out.
In an effort to keep the virus at bay, a majority of African governments have chosen not to evacuate their citizens. Trade between China and Africa has raised fears of a coronavirus outbreak across the continent because of the volume of air traffic between some African countries and China. Most African countries have increased surveillance in their various ports of entry to ensure that the virus does not sneak in. Some African airlines, including Kenya Airways, have cancelled scheduled flights to China as a safety measure. Kenya's Director General of Health, Dr. Patrick Amoth, said everything is being done to ensure that Kenyans stuck in China, including a team of acrobats, are comfortable.
However, the situation in China is now getting better in terms of the numbers, and we'll continue to provide that psychosocial support. We are also going ahead to be able to give further support in terms of finances. Yesterday, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs released Kenya shillings 1.3 million to be distributed to the 100 students plus the acrobats in China for their upkeep. Further, the People's Republic of China also donated $5,000 worth of provisions, which the Kenyan embassy in Beijing is processing for onward transmission to the students.
Over 2,000 people infected with the virus have died, while more than 75,000 infections have been confirmed so far. Cases have been confirmed in at least 26 other countries, but so far, none in sub-Saharan Africa. Raya Lombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
In the latest court development, Sudan's ousted ruler Omar al-Bashir is being questioned for alleged money laundering in connection with financing Islamist groups. Salem Salomon has the story.
Former Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir has been questioned for his role in financing international Islamist groups, according to the country's attorney general.
We have organizations like Hamas in our country, and it has its offices.
That was Abdullah Ibrahim, a professor emeritus at the University of Missouri. Ibrahim participated in the country's 1960s revolution and ran for president against al-Bashir in 2010. However, he added that there are some groups in Sudan who see Hamas as a legitimate political movement.
This is the reason why I say we are going to get into semantics. No, I don't want my people to get into this semantic quagmire. But if Bashir is regime or doing money laundering through them, that stands out as a cry worthy of looking into.
Sudan is still designated as a state sponsor of terrorism due to the past administration's support of terrorist groups, including Hamas and Hezbollah. In December, al-Bashir was sentenced to 2 years in correctional facility for corruption and money laundering charges. Last week, Sudanese officials announced the ousted leader will be transferred to the International Criminal Court to face charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity allegedly committed in the Darfur region.
We have very clear-cut accusation against this man, okay? He's wanted by the ICC.
The move by the Supreme Council, Sudan's ruling body, which is currently controlled by the military, was hailed by international observers as an important decision. Cameron Hudson, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Africa Center, told VOA's TV show Africa 54 that the civilian government took a bold step that wouldn't be possible without consulting with the military. The fact that the military changed its position to make a compromise is a big step, Hudson said.
It's a landmark decision, and I think it catapults Sudan from the country that was really leading the international coalition against the court to serving up to the court its biggest and most important case to date in one fell swoop. So it really is a complete 180 on the part of the Sudanese government, and I think a shot in the arm, as they say, for international justice.
Ibrahim agrees that the military has reversed its position on the issue.
The military was the one that was rather opposed in clear-cut terms earlier. But now I don't know whether it is about this Orhan movement to move. I think they are more inclined to come to terms with the civilians. Leaders now, they don't have any qualms about this.
In April, pro-democracy demonstrators toppled al-Bashir and demanded civilian rule. But Ibrahim said what happened last year was a compromise because recent diplomatic announcements, including the meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, were spearheaded by Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. The meeting faced a backlash from pro-Bashir groups.
The structure that we have now is a product of a compromise and a tug of war. And it is not a compromise between revolutionaries of different persuasions. It is a situation in which the revolution gave birth to counter-revolution simultaneously. Some people consider the difficulties by taking these kind of arbitrary decisions as a sign of weakness. No, it is a sign of struggle. If we come to grips with the reality that on that day in April, we had a revolution and a counter-revolution.
Well, for now, it's not clear when the 76-year-old former president will be sent to the ICC. And Hudson said that the Sudanese are a few steps away from seeing him at The Hague. He added that handing al-Bashir over to the ICC paves the way for the peace talks between the government and the armed movements and signals willingness to cooperate with the court.
That is part of a larger peace deal that the government is trying to secure with the remaining armed movements in the country. So it's really dependent upon that kind of comprehensive peace.
Nevertheless, the transitional government's steps to mend international relationships, including outreach to the United States, the United Nations, and Israel, are a historic break from past policies.
It is a completely new Sudan. It's a Sudan that takes justice and accountability and the rule of law seriously for the first time in more than a generation. Obviously, we want to see justice delivered for the many, many victims of atrocity crimes in Darfur. More than 2 million people continue to be displaced inside and outside the country. More than 300,000 people murdered during that conflict in Darfur.
Still, the progress isn't without resistance, as al-Bashir loyalists protested against handing him over to the ICC. And that, Hudson said, is
the last gasp of a fading regime. That's all there is to say.
Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, PJ Elliott, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to sikus, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hi, this is Lori London. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondence reports around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.